Paul Harris filling in for McGraw here at the Big 550 KTRS, and welcoming now to our Verizon Wireless guest line, Richard Stengel is the editor of Time Magazine and the man behind a new book called Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. Mandela, of course, Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa, man who spent 27 years in prison and spent a few years as a pretty good friend of Richard Stengel. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Paul. Thank you.
How did you hook up with Nelson Mandela?
I'm a journalist by trade, as you say, and I worked with him on his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, and went down there in 92 when he'd been out of prison for a couple of years, and was with him through 92, 93, and 94 when he ran for president and was elected. And then basically I, kept a diary, a journal of the time that I spent with him. It's not everybody who gets a chance to spend that much time in an intimate way with one of the greatest men of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd always wanted to basically distill what I learned from him in another book, and that's the origin of Mandela's Way.
Mandela's Way, Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. Let's start in the middle. True or false, Nelson Mandela introduced you to your soon-to-be and now wife.
Well, almost true. She is my wife. She was a South African photographer who had photographed Mandela, and I met her separately from him. But then when he saw that we became friends, he would separately urge each of us to marry the other one. And so he was in many ways the kind of godfather to our marriage. And he's actually technically the godfather of my oldest son, whose middle name comes from Nelson Mandela's real first name, which very few people know, which is a very hard to pronounce word in the Xhosa language called Rolihlahla. So that's my son's middle name.
He's going to have to spell that his entire life, you know.
Well, I don't quite know whether he can really do it, and I will spell it for you now just to show you how impossible it is. It's R-O-L-I-H-L-A-H-L-A.
Yeah, he's going to be put every application, every time he has to fill out a credit card, everything, he's going to be spelling that for his entire life. But
I guess but it's better than giving it to him as his first name, I guess.
And a nice tribute to a man who you became so close to through the years.
True.
So let's
true.
Go, if we leave that as the love part in the middle here, let's go to the courage part. Here's a guy who, as I mentioned, spent 27 years in prison, and then afterwards worked to get his nation his first multiracial democratic elections, which led to him being elected president of South Africa, a time that must have been personally impossibly difficult for him to resume normal life after more than two dozen years in prison. How does a man resume any kind of normal life after that?
Well, Paul, in reality, of course, he couldn't. I mean, he emerged from prison after 27 years as one of the most famous people on the planet and instantly became one of the most recognized people on the planet. In fact, one of the very charming things about him, because he's a man of great humility too, is that, he went back and lived in this tiny little four-room house in Soweto in the black township that's part of Johannesburg. And when tour buses came by, he used to get out and walk onto the bus and introduce himself to everybody on the tour bus. I mean, he just had never, think about it. He'd missed modern life. I mean, he didn't know what television was. He barely knew what radio was. I mean, he had to kind of adapt himself to modern life at the same time while being one of the most famous people on the planet and, of course, trying to unite his country and achieve democracy in a place where it had never existed before.
Mm-hmm. And in doing so, he's leading this kind of normal, everyday kind of guy life, and also simultaneously being one of the most famous people in the world, and also at the same time trying to fight off the after effects of apartheid with F.W. de Klerk. Now, the two of them shared the Nobel Prize in 1993, but in looking through what you've written here, I'm still curious about what their relationship might have been in the long term.
It's a very interesting question, and I spent some time with them together, and I've spent some time separately with de Klerk since. One of the lessons in the book, and one of the things that I learned from Mandela and Mandela teaches, is to is to try to see the good in others, and I think he always did that. He did that with his jailers and with his guards and with his, you know, antagonists, and I think he did it with F.W. de Klerk, and I think he felt that de Klerk was a truly worthy partner. But then he became disappointed and felt that maybe he had overestimated de Klerk, or maybe he had thought that his motives were more benign than they turned out to be. And they have a very complicated relationship. And I wouldn't say that it was a close one. And I think both men have reservations about the other. And he was one of the few people that Mandela ever kind of openly expressed any reservations about.
Yeah. Did either of them feel used by the other in an exploitative way?
I think I could fairly say that they both felt that way. You know, where the truth really lies, I don't really know. But I think they would both say that.
Talking with Richard Stengel, the editor of Time magazine, about his new book, Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage, here on the Big 550 KTRS. Now let's talk a little bit about your relationship with him, because it seems like you had highs and lows with him, and at times saw him as a man who wasn't always the good guy. True?
Well, it's not that he wasn't always the good guy. He was often the tough guy. I mean, one of the things that's happened with Nelson Mandela is the kind of what I would call the Santa Clausification of Nelson Mandela. He's this kindly, you know, white-haired old man who represents, you know, virtue and
well,
morality.
Now he's Morgan Freeman.
Well, right, exactly. Yes, if Morgan Freeman can play you, you can be God or Nelson Mandela. And but remember when that fellow went to prison, you know, when he was 46 years old, I mean, he was in some ways the leader of the African National Congress, which was the revolutionary movement in South Africa that was a violent revolutionary movement, and he actually was the first leader of their you know, military wing. And you know, he has made very difficult and hard decisions all through his life, and he was harassed by the police and white supremacists and treated you know, worse than you'd want to treat any living thing. And so he's not a kindly, gentle, grandfatherly man. He's a man who's lived a very, very rough life, and including, as you said, a bunch of times, 27 years in prison. And you know, that wasn't the you know, the kind of country club prisons that you know, sometimes we hear about. You know, he was on for 18 years of that time. He was on Robben Island, this Alcatraz of South Africa, you know, in chopping stones. And so he had a very, very rough road. I wouldn't worst enemy.
5 years before he was released by de Klerk, de Klerk's predecessor, Botha, offered Mandela conditional release if he would renounce armed struggle.
Right.
Mandela refused to do that and spent 5 more years in this prison. Why, after 22 years in the prison, was he still not willing to say, we should put down our arms and stop fighting this fight?
Because he believed it would look like he was surrendering. And he famously said in the remarks that were released when he turned down Botha's offer, he said that my freedom cannot be separated from the freedom of ordinary South Africans. And he felt it would have been a betrayal not only of his movement, but a betrayal of ordinary South Africans who were also fighting for their freedom if he renounced a military means of trying to overthrow the minority white regime.
You talked about his popularity. Is he universally loved in South Africa?
I think he's pretty much universally loved in South Africa, and part of his achievement and part of the lessons in Mandela's Way is how he did, you know, unify the country, white and black. I mean, this was a country whose, you know, racial history was even more fraught than our own, and you know, it was a system of apartheid where people of color had separate laws. It was, you know, it was like America before the Civil War, and so he managed to triumph over that and become the leader of you know, what Bishop Tutu called the Rainbow Nation, you know, a nation of many colors. And I think that the whites in South Africa today adore him and miss him and wish, you know, that he were still around to lead the nation, because he did make it you know, the very core of what he was trying to do is to unite people across the color bar.
It's amazing to think that two decades later, is there really racial harmony throughout South Africa?
You know, there's still a lot of the same economic iniquities. There's a much more robust, you know, black middle class and upper class, but you know, there's still a tremendous amount of poverty, and there's still you know, people without running water and without electricity, and the HIV rate is very, very high. The unemployment rate is stratospheric, much higher than our own. And so I think their problems are not, it's not that there's no racial element to it, but they're economic problems now. They're not problems of racism and prejudice the way they once were, even though, of course, that still exists, as it exists pretty much everywhere.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Richard Stengel, editor of Time Magazine, author of Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage, culled from the years that he has known Nelson Mandela. Number one on the list, courage is not the absence of fear. So 100% right. Explain it.
What happened was that when I would be talking with him and we were talking through his life and history, he would tell me about an incident in prison or before prison, and he would say, you know, man, I was terrified, or I was so scared, or I was trembling with fear. And I thought, my God, Nelson Mandela is telling me that he's afraid, that he's terrified. How can Nelson Mandela be terrified and fearful? I mean, I know how I can be, and I know how, you know, pretty much everybody else can be, but I thought, well, how can Nelson Mandela feel fear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, when we started talking about this, he would say, well, of course I felt fear, and it would be, as he said, irrational not to have been fearful if someone was about to club you or someone had a gun. But what I realized from early on as a leader and as someone who others looked up to, I had to pretend that I wasn't afraid. I had to put up a front, as he put it. And you know, what he says is that you know, courage, again, is not the absence of fear, but courage is learning how to tampen down your fear, to focus on the fear and try to rise above it. And that's what he did all of his life.
Right. It's not that you're not afraid. It's that despite the fear, you still run into the building or go to war or fight the fight that you have to fight, regardless of how you're feeling in the pit of your stomach. That's courage. If you're not afraid, it's not courageous.
That's exactly right. You put it very, very well.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about a couple of the other lessons you learned. And by the way, of these 15 lessons you've got listed here in the book, how many do you think you've applied to your own life?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, part of the way in writing this book, you know, I wanted to figure out, well, what did I really learn from him, from this special, unique experience of spending so much time with, you know, one of the greatest men of the 20th century. And these are the lessons in a way that I both distilled from him and tried to teach myself. And so, you know, the ones that I think about all the time, I mean, it's the courage one that you mentioned, you know, be measured, which is to, you know, be controlled, to not overreact to things. See the good in others is something which was very much part of his being. You know, one of my favorite ones is it's always both, which is, you know, I would ask him a question, I'd say, well, you know, Madiba, which is what everybody called him, is, you know, is the reason you did this, you know, because you wanted to impress the government, or was it because you wanted to keep the goodwill of your followers? And he'd always look at me when I asked questions like that with a kind of quizzical look, and then finally he would go, well, why not both? You know, the answer for him is always both. I mean, he sees life as not black and white, but complex and many shades of gray, and that there never is one answer, you know, to any particular question. And you'd think that someone like Nelson Mandela, this great freedom fighter, would kind of see things in this kind of stark, you know, good and evil way, but he doesn't. I mean, he doesn't see people that way. He doesn't see politics that way. He doesn't see anything that way.
So after his more than nine decades on this planet and the struggles and decisions that have been a part of his life, who does he hold in high esteem?
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't mean to be too, you know, mention names that folks might not know, but I mean, he he admired the colleagues that went with him to prison, who were in the Rivonia trial. That was this trial where they were convicted of treason for trying to overthrow the white minority regime. Were in effect his, not only his friends, but his heroes. A man named Walter Sisulu, who basically brought him into the freedom struggle, who was significantly older, was in some ways Mandela's own, you know, great guide and teacher. Oliver Tambo, who was his law partner, who later became the head of the ANC, was also a hero to him. But he also talks about, you know, figures that he admired as a young man. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was somebody that he talked to me about and that he'd studied in school. He listened in real time when he was in school to Winston Churchill's radio addresses to Great Britain during World War II, and he remembers being inspired by that. So Gandhi was another person that he learned a great deal from and who inspired the
Gandhi was nonviolent, and yet here's Mandela, who would not eschew violence as a way to get what he wanted.
Well, because Mandela, again, which is something I want people to see in Mandela's way, is a pragmatist. I mean, he had a moral, overarching moral goal, but then he would do almost anything to get to that goal. And so what he said to me, and I talk about that in one of the chapters too, is that, and this is a very hard-headed, pragmatic thing to say, is that he said, you know, to him, nonviolence was a strategy. It wasn't a moral principle. And just the way that embracing violence was a strategy too, and that he did not, in the way that Gandhi did, feel that nonviolence was an inflexible moral principle that could never be violated under any circumstances. You know, that principle to him was democracy, of giving freedom to the people who were denied freedom in South Africa. But whether you used violence or nonviolence to get there, to him was a strategy, not morality.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking to Richard Stengel, editor of Time Magazine, author of Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. Number 14, quitting is leading to. I'm guessing that Nelson Mandela doesn't mean it in the way Sarah Palin means it.
He might. I mean, I think he would. He'd look at that, and he would, as I would say, he sees everybody in all different shades of gray. So he said, well, I can understand that. I mean, and what I meant by that is that, I mean, he's a person who can be stubborn and bullheaded, but at a certain point he realizes that you know, either you're not, you know, either your point of view is not going to win, or maybe you're wrong, and that, you know, sometimes, you know, as somebody said, surrendering is going over to the winning side, that he would, there were things that he was adamant about, and then I would see that there was a lot of opposition, and then I'd see he would change his mind, and you know, as he said, you know, when circumstances change, you change your mind, and I think it's a great principle to look at in our politics, because, you know, people, you know, on every side or both sides are so certain about everything, and that it seems like a weakness to change your mind about things, and in fact he would say it's a strength. I mean, and it's strength to be able to look at how things change and then adapt your point of view.
It's also odd for politicians to admit that they've changed their mind. I know in your years with Time Magazine, you probably have rarely seen politicians say, you know what, I changed my mind, because then they're accused of flip-flopping.
Exactly right. I mean, they think it seems like a weakness to change your mind. I think voters often do too, which I think doesn't make sense. I think it's a strength when you change your mind. You know, one of my great heroes and writers is Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once said, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds."
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying, you know, someone who doesn't change their mind when circumstances change is foolish.
Absolutely right. Is there a new Nelson Mandela on the scene now, whether an emerging one or already in a leadership position on the world stage?
You know, it's funny. I mean, one of the things that I, you know, being a kind of amateur historian myself, and, you know, the frame, I've read and written a lot about the framers of the United States, the great statesmen, you know, Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and I once asked another historian, you know, was it just special circumstances that those men and people were born at the same time? Was it the circumstances that created them? Is, you know, And he said to me, look, I think there are people like that living now, but there are no kind of circumstances which put them together. And there was a great group of kind of framers in South Africa led by Nelson Mandela, but you don't really see them today. I don't know that anybody else really comes up to their level. And sometimes because, you know, when things become better, leaders don't necessarily arise. There's an old English expression, cometh the moment, cometh the man. And I think, you know, now there hasn't been anyone who really has stepped forward who could really fill his shoes.
All right, one last thing I've got to ask you about before I let you go, Richard, and that is his relationship with Winnie Mandela, who was from the same area he was from. They met in Johannesburg. She was the city's first black social worker, and they were a partnership, a team, even for all those years that he spent in prison. And yet he gets out of prison, and pretty soon the relationship is over, and he eventually goes on and remarries marries for a third time. What happened there? Was it prison that changed him in a way that he and Winnie couldn't get along together, or were they a couple that were better off apart than together? What's the story behind that broken relationship?
It's a good question, Paul, and it's a very complicated one. I mean, obviously, being, you know, having 27 years apart in a marriage is a difficult thing. And in many ways, and as he would often say to me, she had a harder time than he did. I mean, trying to raise a family in an apartheid South Africa, going in and out of prison as she often did, being hounded by the police, was extremely difficult. And there are very few people under the circumstances that either of them had that wouldn't have broken, that wouldn't have, you know, gone around the bend a little bit. And I think, you know, what happened with Winnie is that she really struggled with all those years, and she's continued to struggle even after he came out of prison. And she had become a freedom leader in her own right. And I think it was just a kind of impossible union to hold. I mean, she had been, you know, she had been accused of various crimes during the, you know, even after the time that he came out of prison. And so it was just I think he felt that for his own good and for the good of the movement and the good of the country, they had to separate.
So it wasn't that he got home and she figured, he snores, I can't take it, I'm out of here.
No. No, I think he devoutly wanted for it to work out and for them to stay married. And he treasured the memories that he had of her, you know, during the time he was in prison, and, you know, just how tough prison was in the beginning. I mean, I think in the first few years, I mean, maybe one visit a year was all that they were allowed. You know, in later years, it became easier. But he, you know, he really felt that he missed out on a true family life, and he did.
The book is called Mandela's Way: 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage, written by Time magazine editor Richard Stengel. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure.
Richard Stengel on the Verizon Wireless guest line here on the Big 550 KTRS with Paul Harris doing the McGraw Show.